Chapter 4. Epping Hunt. For though our artist does not draw horses very scientifically, to use a phrase of the Atelier, he feels them very keenly, and his queer animals, after one is used to them, answer quite as well as better. Neither is he very happy in trees, and such rustical produce. Or, rather, we should say, he is very original, his trees being decidedly of his own make and composition, not imitated from any master. But what then? Can a man be supposed to imitate everything? We know what the noblest study of mankind is, and to this Mr. Cruikshank has confined himself. That postillion with the people in the broken-down chaise roaring after him is as deaf as the post by which he passes. Suppose all the accessories were away, could not one swear that the man was stone deaf, beyond the reach of trumpet? What is the peculiar character in a deaf man's physiognomy? Can any person define it satisfactorily in words, not in pages? And Mr. Cruikshank has expressed it on a piece of paper, not so big as the tenth part of your thumbnail. The horses of John Gilpin are much more of the equestrian order. And as here the artist has only his favorite suburban buildings to draw, not a word is to be said against his design. The inn and old buildings are charmingly designed, and nothing can be more prettily or playfully touched. T. Edmund and his loving wife from the balcony spied her tender husband, wondering much to see how he did ride. Stop, stop, John Gilpin. Here's the house. Apostrophe they all at once did cry. The dinner waits, and we are tired, apostrophe said Gilpin, so am I. Apostrophe, apostrophe, ex gentlemen upon the road thus seeing Gilpin fly, with postboy scampering in the rear, they raised the hue and cry. Stop thief, a highwayman. Apostrophe, not one of them was mute, and all and each that passed that way did join in the pursuit. And now the turnpike gates again flew open in short space. The tollmen thinking, as before, that Gilpin rode a race. The rush, and shouting, and clatter are excellently depicted by the artist, and we, who have been scoffing at his manner of designing animals, must here make a special exception in favor of the hens and chickens. Each has a different action, and is curiously natural. Happy are children of all ages who have such a ballad, and such pictures as this in store for them. It is a comfort to think that woodcuts never wear out, and that the book still may be had for a shilling for those who can command that sum of money. In the Epping Hunt, which we owe to the facetious pen of Mr. Hood, our artist has not been so successful. There is here too much horsemanship, and not enough incident for him. But the portrait of Roundings the Huntsman is an excellent sketch, and a couple of the designs contain great humor. The first represents the Cockney hero, who, like a bird, was singing out while sitting on a tree. And in the second the natural order is reversed. The stag having taken heart, is hunting the huntsman, and the Cheapside Nimrod is most ignominiously running away. The Easter Hunt, we are told, is no more, and as the Quarterly Review recommends the British public to purchase Mr. Catlin's pictures, as they form the only record of an interesting race now rapidly passing away, in like manner we should exhort all our friends to purchase Mr. Cruikshank's designs of another interesting race that is run already, and for the last time. Besides these, we must mention, in the line of our duty, the notable tragedies of Om Thumb and Ombus's Furioso, both of which have appeared with many illustrations by Mr. Cruikshank. The brave army of bombists exhibits a terrific display of brutal force, which must shock the sensibilities of an English radical. And we can well understand the caution of the general, who bids this old Tescafrani to beggin, and not to kick up a row. Such a troop of lawless ruffians, let loose upon a populous city, would play sad havoc in it. And we fancy the massacres of Birmingham renewed, or at least of Badages, which, though not quite so dreadful, if we may believe His Grace the Duke of Wellington, as the former scenes of slaughter, were nevertheless severe enough. But we must not venture upon any ill-timed pleasantries in presence of the disturbed King Arthur, and the awful ghost of Gaffer Thumb. We are thus carried at once into the supernatural, and here we find Cruikshank reigning supreme. He has invented in his time a little comic pandemonium, peopled with the most droll, good-natured fiends possible. We have before us Chamisso's Eder Schlemmel, with Cruikshank's designs translated into German, and gaining nothing by the change. The Inder und Hans Märchen of Grimm are likewise ornamented with a frontispiece copied from that one which appeared to the amusing version of the English work. The books on phrenology and time have been imitated by the same nation. And even in France, whither reputation travels slower than to any country except China, we have seen copies of the works of George Cruikshank. He in return has complimented the French by illustrating a couple of lives of Napoleon and the Eiffel in Paris before mentioned. He has also made designs for Victor Hugo's Anne of Iceland. Strange wild etchings were those, on a strange, mad subject. Not so good in our notion as the designs for the German books, the peculiar humor of which latter seemed to suit the artist exactly. There is a mixture of the awful and the ridiculous in these, which perpetually excites and keeps awake the reader's attention. The German writer and the English artist seem to have an entire faith in their subject. The reader, no doubt, remembers the awful passage in Peter Schlemmel, where the little gentleman purchases the shadow of that hero of the kindness, noble sir, to examine and try this bag. He put his hand into his pocket, and drew thence a tolerably large bag of Cordovan leather, to which a couple of thongs were fixed. I took it from him, and immediately counted out 10 gold pieces, and 10 more, and 10 more, and still other 10, whereupon I held out my hand to him. "Done," said I, "it is a bargain. You shall have my shadow for your bag." The bargain was concluded. He knelt down before me, and I saw him with a wonderful neatness take my shadow from head to foot, lightly lift it up from the grass, roll and fold it up neatly, and at last pocket it. He then rose up, bowed to me once more, and walked away again, disappearing behind the rose bushes. I don't know, but I thought I heard him laughing a little. I, however, kept fast hold of the bag. Everything around me was bright in the sun, and as yet I gave no thought to what I had done. This marvelous event, narrated by Peter with such a faithful, circumstantial detail, is painted by Cruikshank in the most wonderful poetic way, with that happy mixture of the real and supernatural that makes the narrative so curious and like truth. The sun is shining with the utmost brilliance in a great quiet park or garden. There is a palace in the background, and a statue basking in the sun quite lonely and melancholy. There is a sundial, on which is a deep shadow, and in the front stands Peter Schlemmel, bag in hand. The old gentleman is down on his knees to him, and has just lifted off the ground the shadow of one leg. He is going to fold it back neatly, as one does the tails of a coat, and will stow it, without any creases or crumples, along with the other black garments that lie in that immense pocket of his. Cruikshank has designed all this, as if he had a very serious belief in the story. He laughs, to be sure, but one fancies that he is a little frightened in his heart, in spite of all his fun and joking. The German tales we have mentioned before. He prints writing on the fox, Hans in luck, comma, the fiddler, and his goose, comma, heads off, are all drawings which, albeit not before us now, nor seen for 10 years, remain indelibly fixed on the memory. Ice duet Rumpelstiltskin? There sits the queen on her throne, surrounded by grinning beefeaters, and little Rumpelstiltskin stamps his foot through the floor in the excess of his tremendous despair. In one of these German tales, if we remember rightly, there is an account of a little orphan who is carried away by a pitying fairy for a term of 7 years, and passing that period of sweet apprenticeship among the imps and sprites of fairyland. Has our artist been among the same company, and brought back their portraits in his sketchbook? He is the only designer fairyland has had. Callot's imps, for all their strangeness, are only of the earth earthy. Fuseli's fairies belong to the infernal regions. They are monstrous, lurid, and hideously melancholy. Mr. Cruikshank alone has had a true insight into the character of the Idle people. They are something like men and women, and yet not flesh and blood. They are laughing and mischievous, but why we know not. Mr. Cruikshank, however, has had some dream or the other, or else a natural mysterious instinct, as the Saturn of Prevorst had for beholding ghosts, or else some preternatural fairy revelation, which has made him acquainted with the looks and ways of the fantastical subjects of Oberon and Titania. We have, unfortunately, no fairy portraits, but, on the other hand, can descend lower than fairyland, and have seen some fine specimens of devils. One has already been raised, and the reader has seen him tempting a fat Dutch burgomaster, in an ancient gloomy marketplace, such as George Cruikshank can draw as well as Mr. Prout, Mr. Nash, or any man living. There is our friend once more, our friend the burgomaster, in a highly excited state, and running as hard as his great legs will carry him, with our mutual enemy at his tail. What are the bets? Will that long-legged bondholder of a devil come up with the honest Dutchman? It serves him right. Why did he put his name to stamped paper? And yet we should not wonder if some lucky chance should turn up in the burgomaster's favor, and his infernal creditor lose his labor. For one so proverbially cunning as yonder tall individual with the saucer eyes, it must be confessed that he has been very often outwitted. There is, for instance, the case of the gentleman in black, which has been illustrated by our artist. A young French gentleman, by name M. Desange, who, having expended his patrimony in a variety of taverns and gaming houses, was one day pondering upon the exhausted state of his finances, and utterly at a loss, to think how he should provide means for future support, exclaimed, "Very naturally, what the devil shall I do?" He had no sooner spoken than a gentleman in black made his appearance, whose authentic portrait Mr. Cruikshank has had the honor to paint. This gentleman produced a black-edged book out of a black bag, some black-edged papers tied up with black crepe, and sitting down familiarly opposite M. Desange, began conversing with him on the state of his affairs. It is needless to state what was the result of the interview. M. Desange was induced by the gentleman to sign his name to one of the black-edged papers, and found himself at the close of the conversation to be possessed of an unlimited command of capital. This arrangement completed, the gentleman in black posted in an extraordinarily rapid manner from Paris to London, there found a young English merchant in exactly the same situation in which M. Desange had been, and concluded a bargain with a Briton of exactly the same nature. The book goes on to relate how these young men spent the money so miraculously handed over to them, and how both, when the period drew near that was to witness the performance of their part of the bargain, grew melancholy, wretched, nay, so absolutely dishonorable, as to seek for every means of breaking through their agreement. The Englishman living in a country where the lawyers are more astute than any other lawyers in the world, took the advice of a Mr. Baxby, of Lyon's Inn, whose name, as we cannot find it in the list, we presume to be fictitious. Who could it be that was a match for the devil? Lord, very likely, we shall not give his name, but let every reader of this review fill up the blank according to his own fancy, and on comparing it with the copy purchased by his neighbors, he will find that 15 out of 20 have written down the same honored name. Well, the gentleman in black was anxious for the fulfillment of his bond. The parties met at Mr. Baxby's chambers to consult, the black gentleman foolishly thinking that he could act as his own counsel, and fearing no attorney alive. But mark the superiority of British law, and see how the black pettifogger was defeated. Mr. Baxby simply stated that he would take the case into Chancery, and his antagonist, utterly humiliated and defeated, refused to move a step farther in the matter. And now the French gentleman, M. Desange, hearing of his friend's escape, became anxious to be free from his own rash engagements. He employed the same counsel who had been successful in the former instance, But the gentleman in black was a great deal wiser by this time, and whether M. Desange escaped, or whether he is now in that extensive place which is paved with good intentions, we shall not say. Those who are anxious to know had better purchase the book wherein all these interesting matters are duly set down. There is one more diabolical picture in our budget, engraved by Mr. Thompson, the same dexterous artist who has rendered the former Diablerie so well. We may mention Mr. Thompson's name, as among the first of the engravers to whom Cruikshank's designs have been entrusted. And next to him, if we may be allowed to make such arbitrary distinctions, we may place Mr. Williams. And the reader is not possibly aware of the immense difficulties to be overcome in the rendering of these little sketches, which, traced by the designer in a few hours, require weeks' labor from the engraver. Mr. Cruikshank has not been educated in the regular schools of drawing, very luckily for him, as we think, and consequently has had to make a manner for himself, which is quite unlike that of any other draftsman. There is nothing in the least mechanical about it. To produce his particular effects, he uses his own particular lines, which are queer, free, fantastical, and must be followed in all their infinite twists and vagaries by the careful tool of the engraver. Those three lovely heads, for instance, imagined out of the rinds of lemons, are worth examining, not so much for the jovial humor and wonderful variety of feature exhibited in these darling countenances as for the engraver's part of the work. See the infinite delicate cross lines and hatchings which he is obliged to render. Let him go, not a hair's breadth, but the hundredth part of a hair's breadth, beyond the given line, and the feeling of it is ruined. He receives these little dots and specks, and fantastical quirks of the pencil, and cuts away with a little knife round each, not too much nor too little. Antonio's pound of flesh did not puzzle the Jew so much, and so well does the engraver succeed at last, that we never remember to have met with a single artist who did not vow that the woodcutter had utterly ruined his design. Of Messrs. Thompson and Williams we have spoken as the first engravers in point of rank. However, the regulations of professional precedence are certainly very difficult, and the rest of their brethren we shall not endeavor to class. Why should the artists who executed the cuts of the admirable recourses yield the pause to anyone? There, for instance, is an engraving by Mr. Landells, nearly as good in our opinion as the very best woodcut that ever was made after Cruikshank, and curiously happy in rendering the artist's peculiar manner. This cut does not come from the facetious publications which we have consulted, but is a contribution by Mr. Cruikshank to an elaborate and splendid botanical work upon the Orchidaceae of Mexico, by Mr. Bateman. Mr. Bateman dispatched some extremely choice roots of this valuable plant to a friend in England, who, on the arrival of the case, consigned it to his gardener to unpack. A great deal of anxiety with regard to the contents was manifested by all concerned, but on the lid of the box being removed, there issued from it three or four fine specimens of the enormous bladder beetle that had been preying upon the plants during the voyage. Against these the gardeners, the grooms, the porters, and the porters. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.